we'll get underway.
Okay, so.
Just a reminder that just you're already figured it out. You have to toggle that and then you have to turn it off.
Oh.
And only four mics can be live at once, but I don't think you'll have that problem. If you just prompt people to turn it off when they're done, that'd be helpful.
So I was going to recognize Norm, Brad Cook.
Norm was actually here at last meeting.
Okay.
Well, I guess he's officially. He's officially.
Like
but Brad's filling in for Scott Wyatt.
Yeah.
Ruth Watkins, our first meeting, and Matt is last. Yeah. Anything else to?
No, I think that's.
Stan, I took those and gave them to Kimberly. Do you want?
No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Yeah. Holy fees.
I'll bring it back in a
This
moment.
Is really key to the Salt Lake.
Yeah.
Like to call us to order. And just a couple things. First of all, you'll notice that on the microphone in front of you that there's a on the right side says speak, and so if you have a comment to make, please make sure and hit that button. But we also ask that when you're through that you turn it off, since we're limited to the number of mics that can actually be in the speak mode. So please just take note of that. I want to recognize Interim President Norm Tarbox here in his official capacity this time, and we welcome you and appreciate your being here. Want to recognize Brad Cook and his being here supporting President Wyatt, and appreciate you being here, Brad. Want to recognize President Watkins in her first official role. Although she's a friend and has been here many times, we want to recognize that first official engagement. And certainly, you know, it's a little anticlimactic with President Holland. We gave a resolution last time and everything because it seemed to be
keep coming back.
Well, be interested in next meeting to see if you make it or not. But recognize President Holland's last official meeting being with us here. So wish him well. Well, I will turn the time now to President Hufdelin for the President's report.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being with us. And before I start, if I can just make a comment. I know you might think this room always looks this good, but we don't always have this banner, Welcome Regents. We don't always have these things. So those are on our staff at SLCC who have done the window dressing, will you please stand and let us acknowledge you? It's a beautiful space. And it doesn't just materialize, so I really appreciate those that have been involved getting ready to host you. It is a pleasure to have you on our campus. So, what a year. We've had a phenomenal year at Salt Lake Community College, and I'm happy to have some time to share some of those highlights. Washington Monthly Magazine named Salt Lake Community College to its list of the 12 most innovative colleges for adult learners, which we are very proud of. The way we adapt our learning and our services to meet the needs of adults who are 25 and older. It makes me sad to think that 25 and older is an old student, but we recently welcomed our men's and women's basketball teams back, who were both in the national tournaments this year, and our men are playing baseball right now in Twin Falls, hoping to get to the national tournament as well. And just 2 weeks ago, we celebrated commencement with one of the largest classes in our history. A little over 4,000 students graduated for us. And the metric that I'm most proud of is over 1,500 of those identified as first-generation students. The graduates ranged in age from 16, our youngest, to 69, our oldest. And it was just a remarkable day. So thanks to those of you that were able to join us. Having just celebrated so many amazing and successful graduates, I wanted to introduce you to a few of our finest students who represented Salt Lake Community College as our graduates of excellence for the class of 2018, and I'll show this short video.
I wake up at 3, and then it's really go, go, go.
Get ready to join the post screen that leaves meeting at 5:30 a.m.
And I'm here, go to the classes all day.
I do my 3 sessions where I work, so I can get going, heading to class for a few hours, taking a break, doing some studying,
schoolwork, and family chores.
Everything music related as well as math. And then after that, I'll go to work.
What motivates me is just that zeal to be a better person. I didn't like the kind of job I was doing. I wanted a better life for myself. And those are part of the things that really motivates me to make sure I get this done, understand what I'm doing, and apply it and live a good life.
Yeah, receiving this award is not just for me. I see it as for all of us because of all the work that everybody's been doing, how hard they're trying. I'm just a lucky guy who just happened to get this. So like community college has helped me out to such a degree that it's given me a hope for a great future in life.
A few years ago, I was in a really bad accident. Doctors told me I'd likely never walk again. They told me that I would struggle continuing school, but I worked really hard at gaining all of that back. That accident really motivated me to just do as much as I can with my life and really be an example for other people that have gone through hardships like that.
Honestly, it's hard not to be motivated with the people who are around me. My mom is the hardest working person I've ever met, and the influence that she has in the community, the ways that she helps other people is really inspiring. I want to be like her, and I want to be like the other role models in my life who go out and they do something good with their lives and they help other people.
So the community college is a wonderful spot. I don't just, despite the fact that I want to have good grades, I also see the opportunity to learn as much as I can so I can make more diplomatic decisions and acquire more skills that can be useful in the society.
Music has brought such a joy to my life that I want other people to experience it, especially those who might not have otherwise been able to experience it. I think about how much of an impact I'm leaving with my peers, my teachers, my coworkers, and my students. I want to leave a bigger impact and leave, a footprint and a legacy for people to follow.
I went to SWIFT knowing that academically I would have to achieve higher, but when those professors and teachers and other students created those relationships with me, showed me that it was possible, then for myself, why not? I mean, if I can be better than I am, why shouldn't I be?
We have remarkable students, and it was great to have them and honor them as examples and as representatives of the different schools at our commencement. So you are at the South City campus, one of our 10 sites, and it's considered really our arts and media campus. You were here last year, but I just wanted to remind you of the kind of dedicated space that we kind of create here. Throughout the year, this campus is really a beehive of activity. We have countless recitals, performances, art exhibits, in addition to the President's Art Show, which we have annually, which is a juried show for community artists, a little over 200 pieces of art for a 10-day run. We also host our annual student art show here. And when we meet later in the atrium, and maybe you saw those this morning, you'll see several student art pieces that were displayed as part of our student art show. And were really phenomenal works from our great faculty and our great students. Also in this space is the crown jewel of performance experience spaces, the Grand Theater. Many of you have been to that, and more on that later. And to mention a few of the highlights of the community that we brought to this campus this year, we were really honored to host the NPR political correspondent, Mara Liasson, who spoke at the Grand Theater as part of our Tanner Forum Conference on Social Ethics. In partner with Westminster College, we brought poet, author, and activist Nikki Giovanni here to be our 2018 Martin Luther King Jr. commemorative keynote speaker. And during Black History Month, we welcomed author and activist Bobby Seale to the Grand as well. As the community's college, it's also essential that we connect with many community partners. And I'm pleased to tell you about two this morning. For the last year or so, we've stewarded a partnership with Flourish Bakery, a nonprofit supportive community that fosters hope, health, and personal growth by employing individuals in recovery from substance abuse or folks who have just reintegrated society after being incarcerated. We leased out our kitchen, which we were not using here at the South City campus, and Flourish provides a 12-month bakery and pastry arts training program as a paid internship for those students. That training is then followed by an externship placement at a local hotel, restaurant, or bakery, or a catering company. Upon graduation, Flourish bakers have moved on to become farmers and growers, local artists and craft makers, professionals in retail and marketing, and societal contributors in small business. We're pleased to have the bakers from Flourish Bakery provided our wonderful apple coffee cake this morning, and they'll be also offering dessert options for you at lunch. So it's a wonderful partnership with a nonprofit that's doing phenomenal things in our community. Another example of our community partnership is on display in our East Lobby with an art exhibit called The Ability to Create. It shares art by adults with disabilities who are being served by Turn Community Services. So it's a way for those adults to engage in art and then have their artwork displayed at a very public space and feel the kind of honor and respect that comes with that. To the northwest of this campus, construction is wrapping up on our new West Point Workforce Training and Education Center. Thanks to all of you who had a part in helping us with that. 120,000 square foot facility, which is going to meet the rapidly evolving needs of industry in the Salt Lake Valley. Many of you heard about that this morning, which programs include composites, diesel tech, professional truck driving, welding, machining, and solar installation. Yesterday, we hosted over 100 high school students and CTE counselors in that facility to tour the building and to show them about career and technical education and training options and the innovative space that's happening at West Point. So I hope that you can put September 19th on your calendar. We will be having our grand opening of that space, and we would really love to have you there to help us celebrate that. At the other end of the valley, we have growth projections, as we talked earlier, for Salt Lake County's southwest quadrant, which are doubling the rate of other quadrants, with Harriman's current population of 25,000 expected to grow to 43,000 by 2050. So with the purchase and planning of 90 acres of land there and a unique partnership with the University of Utah, we are very hopeful to be able to secure funding in the next session and break ground in the near future on a campus in Harriman. Students there would be able to earn a certificate or a degree from SLCC and then remain at the Harriman campus to complete their final 2 years in certain programs from the University of Utah. And we thank President Watkins and the great transfer partnerships we've developed there. We expect, our numbers project, that if we are successful at that, we would serve 1,600 students when we open and just over about 4,700 by 2025 because of the growing nature of that development in that southwest quadrant. The programs that are offered there include registered nursing to Bachelor of Science in Nursing, Information Systems and Computer Science, teacher training, economics, business, and hospitality management, all programs that we've heard from GOED and others are really important in the Utah economic clusters. So let me tell you a little bit about the work that we've done focusing on completion initiatives and the mental health initiatives that the regions have asked each of the presidents to comment on. I think we've been doing some significant things to help our completion rates go up, and we've been working to help students feel better emotionally and physically and be more successful in their studies. So as you know, the first project I want to talk about is MathWays. You've heard about this at some of our other sister institutions. Many of us have been tackling the math obstacle. As we know, completing mathematics requirements can be a huge stumbling block for many of our students. So over the past few years, we've worked to make sure that students are taking the right course that are right for the particular field of study that they want to go into. In response to the Complete College Utah Initiative and the college's Strategic Completion Initiative, our math department implemented a math pathway, or what we call MathWays. It now allows a student who was college ready in math to complete their quantitative literacy requirement in only one semester. In addition, those who were not college ready are able to proceed through the developmental math pathway in fewer semesters. So we're condensing the time to meet your quantitative literacy degree. Also during this time, we lowered the ACCUPLACER placement requirement, which for many of you is the placement that students take as they come into the college. And we made Math 1030 the quantitative literacy requirement for general studies AS and AA, which all of those taken together has significantly increased the number of students who can earn and finish their quantitative literacy degree quickly. We are in the second year now of our MathWays program, and one result so far is that over a third more students, so about 900 students more, are attaining their quantitative literacy requirement in the fall semester than were before. We believe that to be a really significant step in terms of helping students effectively graduate, meet their completion goals, and move on. We're also exploring alternative math placement methods to ensure that students are guided to the appropriate course. We've done some research on our placement experiment and indicate that there's alternate methods that we may be able to deploy to create a higher likelihood that students can enroll in courses, and particularly college-level courses. So we're looking at that research very closely. I also want to talk a little bit about reverse transfer. Many of you have talked about reverse transfer, and that's one of the Regents initiatives that they wanted us to look at. We know that many students will leave us and kind of head on to a university, a baccalaureate setting before actually completing their goal. And we believe that reverse transfer can actually create a more accurate picture of our success by preparing people to earn a four-year degree or obtaining meaningful employment. So many of our students move on before they completely finish an associate's degree. And we believe that our two-year degree has a lot of value for students. We know that employers say associate's degree have value. We know the metrics in terms of economics say that an associate's degree have value. But many of our students don't earn that associate's degree before they transfer. Basically, reverse transfer allows us to work with the University of Utah or USU or any institution, university institution, to transfer credits back to Salt Lake Community College when a student who's there earning a baccalaureate degree actually earns those credits. So we've worked with the University of Utah and Utah State most specifically. From May 2016 to March 2018, we reached out to 1,166 students at the University of Utah to notify them of our reverse transfer program. About 280 students responded, with 166 transcripts requested, which resulted in about 159 students graduating with an associate's degree from Salt Lake Community College because of the work that they'd done at University of Utah. At USU, we've reached out. We have 330 students who were notified. It's 46 transcript requests and about 31 students so far that have earned an associate's degree, again, while completing their credits toward a baccalaureate at Utah State. So we're trying to strengthen that program and help students see the value of earning an associate's degree, transcripting an associate's degree, and taking that out into the workforce. We are very committed to doing everything we can for students to improve our completion rate and give you all and the business leaders and our public a more accurate portrayal of the success of our students and the excellent staff and faculty who serve them during their first few years at college. Another completion initiative that I want to briefly mention is our SLCC Pathways, a multi-year initiative. This is a heavy lift, but it's going to provide much more support and more an intentional route for students to enhance their learning and create a clear route to completion and further education. We've been putting the mechanics of a Pathways model in place for the last year. We have teams working on this implementation this summer, and we have established guiding principles and prototypes and a new advising model that will really help us advance this model in the next few years. We hope to go live with this in fall of 2019. One of the works that we're doing is, again, with the University of Utah, building a prototype pathway between Salt Lake Community College Social and Behavioral Sciences, Education and Human Services, right to the University of Utah, and hopefully use that as a guide for our other seven areas of study as we build those out. We believe that there are many, many levers we can pull in terms of completion initiatives to get to our strategic goal of a much higher completion rate. Let me switch gears a little to the mental health recommendation and to how we've done given the task force that was assembled by the Regents and the work that we know we have to do on campus regarding students and their mental health. Counseling and health clinics are very, very important on our campus. Whether the need has increased or the availability of services has been able to reach a wider group, it's clear that the number of intakes is significantly different this year. Our Center of Health and Counseling has gone up from 146 in the fall of 2016 to 214 just this past fall, which is a 47% increase. And the numbers this year are already looking and trending to exceed 2017. For us, it's about addressing the entire and the whole student and understanding what's happening in their world, in their life, and how we can help them be more successful. Our counseling services and health clinic collaborate on each student as needed, addressing areas such as depression, PTSD, and lifestyle interventions. The college's counseling and health services are available at this campus, at our Taylorsville campus, and on our Jordan campus. And recently, we've invested in two additional mental health counselors. A psychiatric nurse practitioner were just added in April. So here's what we have to offer our students. We have 5 mental health counselors. We have a psychologist on staff, 4 licensed clinical social workers, a psychiatric nurse practitioner, 8 certified peer educators, crisis services that give zero wait time to top priorities, expanded counseling services at our satellite campus, and a lot of outreach and training for students that are, it's much more not diagnostic, but preventative. We've offered 21 in-person trainings and workshops for more than 290 staff and faculty to help understand how to look for signs and address students' well-being and help them with their emotional needs. We've received equity, diversity, and inclusion grants to help our counselors and our faculty be trained on an innovative method to recognize and treat PTSD. And almost 200 students this year were served by certified peer educators in coordination with our Student Health Advisory Club. We know that students often will listen to peers more than they'll listen to any of us as administrators, and we believe those peer educators are critical to help our students manage stress and anxiety, especially as we know about 3 weeks ago, which was finals week. We've invested in the whole student, not just the academic side of the student. And this investment has resulted in increased visibility and availability of services, more accessible and affordable quality care, and hopefully an increase in the numbers served and a decrease in the stigma of reaching out and asking for help on campus. We've lowered wait times for those services, mostly because of the kind of clinical support that we've resourced through some of our hiring. When the unwritten, sometimes unseen needs of students are met, we help them succeed and ultimately complete this important educational journey. And let me shift gears one more time. I noted earlier a few of the great things taking place specifically on this campus. As home to the Grand Theater, I'm delighted to announce that the show that opened yesterday is Monty Python's Spamalot. If you're familiar with Monty Python, this next moment will make sense. If you're not familiar with Monty Python, you will think I've lost my mind. But we would like you to be a guest at one of our next few weeks' performances. And so I think we have... we have tickets for you all to the next upcoming... it's King Arthur.
Welcome to you all. It's so good to see you this morning. Love to see you. It is my pleasure, as King Arthur, to present to you, as you are all fine Britons.
These are Americans, sir.
Americans?
Yes, sir.
No longer English.
No, sir.
I don't have to say you were teeth. We'd like to please welcome you here and absolutely invite you to come see the glory that
Let me make sure you understand that several of my cabinet members really tried to talk me out of doing that. And I didn't listen to them. I want to thank you for your continued support of Salt Lake Community College. You've heard this morning that our students matter deeply to us. They're a diverse, wonderful, strong asset for our community, and I appreciate the opportunity you give us to serve them. They're phenomenal students. Our faculty and staff are phenomenal, and it's a pleasure for me to serve as president of this unbelievable institution. So thank you.
Before we move to our next item of business, I just want to make sure if there are any questions for President Hufdelin. Any comments, questions? You've answered them all. So, thank you. And I thought that was very enjoyable. So it was great. So,
as long as the chair is happy.
Well, that'll get you about one more hour. Like to turn now to our report of the Governor's Office of Management and Budget. We've had three pilots going with GOMB, and we'd welcome Kristen Cox, who is Executive Director of the Office of Management and Budget.
And Robert, are you here? Yeah, okay, and John? Awesome. Really, they're going to do most of the talking here. And President Cockett, your team's amazing. Just stellar. So I'll talk a little bit and then turn it over. First, I want to disclose, I do not pretend to be an expert in higher education. I am not an expert in higher education. What my shop does is we do budgets, of course, and then we're really pretty good at operations and looking at how resources on the ground are being used. So I want to talk a little bit about what we've done in state government, our approach, kind of our mindset, and the purpose of these pilots really is to see, does any of the tools we've learned about in state government apply to higher ed, or there's lessons learned that could be scaled and used. We're learning through the process some of the challenges you face, and we have three pilots in place. I'll touch about on some of those a little bit. The one that's the most mature is Utah State, so they'll be sharing the most. So, our biggest conflict in our office is the idea that the demand for services will always outweigh available revenue. So for every new dollar we get in new revenue, there's $4 of requests out there from higher ed or public ed or Medicaid or the prison system. I mean, it's just quite frankly pretty staggering. I'm sure as presidents you feel that all the time with all the things you have to manage in your area. So our first step always is, how do we use our existing resources more effectively to get better outcomes? And sometimes when we talk operations, people think, oh, that's for transactional environments, right? A determination for eligibility for food stamps, or, you know, we get a lot of, well, we're different, we're unique, it doesn't apply to us. But we've started doing this across, when we started this project 4 years ago, we set a goal of improving government performance by 25%. And we look at cost, quality, and what we call throughput as a baseline to measure that. We baseline every system, we make a change, we see if we actually got an improvement. We actually hit that 27.4%, and that was everything from adult probation and parole to correctional officers in the prison system to regulatory environments and cleaning up spills when we have toxic waste products going on in our state. So we hit that, and we're now in the middle of re-baselining, and everybody has to set new targets. We just have been doing, for example, the state hospital, which is a challenging environment, right? Forensic competency for people who are significantly mentally ill. 300% improvement, bringing, you know, wait times from 6 months to 60 days, and our target's 14 days by next year. So we've learned a lot, and we still have a lot to learn. Government has so much room for improvement. So that's why we hit the 27, and we're like, we're not done, because there's still so many challenges. And the challenge with government, and I assume maybe you feel it, sometimes government can feel like a black box. On the top, on the very top level, we can see big strategies and initiatives. But for government, most of our costs are tied up in labor and benefits. And it's very difficult to see what's really happening. that can feel hidden to us. So we always talk about looking for hidden capacity. We say that because you can't see it. It's not normally there. Our technology hides it. Our workflow hides it. We can't see what people are doing. Our systems aren't designed to show what's really happening. So you have to know where to go look for it, and when you can find it, it's amazing. So when we started doing these three pilots, we have one with SUU, Scott Wyatt, awesome, and we have one with SLIC and tech colleges, and that's just starting, getting clarity on the goal and where they're going to go. And I'll have a handout on each of those. President Wyatt's looking at true dual immersion, like automatic enrollment between the tech and higher ed. It's amazing what he's doing. And I know all of you are doing amazing work, but these are the three pilots. With Utah State, we really focused on these ideas of rules of flow. Whenever we go into operations, this is not the cool, sexy stuff, operations, right? But we're looking at how do resources on the ground, how are they currently being utilized before we layer more work on top of them? And there's only seven rules of flow that we talk about when we go into systems. We look at how they're doing triage, quality at source. We're looking at work and process controls. We're looking at very specific things. And I've been doing this now for 10 years, and I have not seen a system yet that has had these rules of flow in place because normally we're not taught. We don't know about them. I still don't do them perfectly in my office. You could all come to my office and find tons of room for me to improve. So one of the rules we talked about with them is this one, just this idea of full kit. And full kit essentially means we don't start work, or a person doesn't start their journey till they have all the information they need to begin their work. And a great example is we do this all the time, and it's so funny. We'll take two groups, and we'll say you're going to go paint a room, and the room is 12 by 12, and teenagers used to live there. What do you need to paint the room? And each group will list what they feel like they need to paint the room. How often do you think those lists line up? Zero. Never. And that's a simple project, right? Painting a room. So you take this concept of I don't start work until I have what I need to begin the work. Well, what does that really mean? So I'm somebody coming out of the prison system, and I'm going to start a new life. What does a full kit look like for me? What do I need to start this next phase of my life? I'm in child welfare investigations, and I'm going to go deal with a family who's been accused of abusing their kid. What does that look like for them? It could be even as simple as an IT project manager. What's all the information I need before I start to develop my project? So full kit is a simple solution, not always easy. And what happens when we don't have full kit, and then I'm going to turn the rest of the time over to these guys, we see some symptoms and systems when there's not a full kit. So first of all, and these guys are working with first-generation students. We don't have all the agreement up front, explicit, of what, let's say in this case, well, let me use the prison example. They need to speak to their issue. Folks coming out of the prison, it's not explicit what they need when they leave. So, number one, we do not have quality at source built in at the very beginning. In government, we do a lot of detection after the fact, after people have already failed or struggled, versus early in. When you have a full kit, you build it up front explicitly. This is what quality means for this individual. So we have quality problems on a lot of rework down the road. When we don't have full kit, we can also have a real challenge coordinating. Because when you full kit, and I have somebody coming out of the prison system, and I know they need, this individual specifically needs mental health treatment, housing, and a job, and they need the housing within 2 weeks, and I'm explicit on that, and that hasn't happened, I get one, early detection. I can see quicker what's happening and what's not. And two, I'm able to coordinate my services. One of the biggest challenges we have in government is coordination. I hate that word. It's overly used. We never solve it. And the reason why we don't solve it, there's three reasons, but one is we never have a common priority level across organizations about what's important. When you full kit and you have clear milestones built in and someone's not achieving those, you know that you have a problem, and then you can start prioritizing across organization what the problem is. And people can naturally gravitate to that versus everybody just doing their own thing. And things just take much longer if we don't full kit. Because again, let's say I'm in child welfare, or child TANF, which is the welfare program, and I tell somebody, go find childcare. We don't full kit that for them. We don't tell them, here's all the providers in your area, and who's here, these are providers will actually accept the kind of subsidy that we're giving you, and you need to have it in 2 weeks. We don't do that for them. All of a sudden, 2 to 3 weeks down the road, they haven't found childcare. We're bringing them back in, we're talking to them. I promise, this is one of the simplest concepts, but what we've seen in terms of getting improvement and starting to pull back the black box and seeing what's happening on the ground is staggering. And I'll close with this and turn it to them. Some of you kind of know my story, but I started going blind and lost a lot of vision when I was in college and went from trying to use magnifying glasses to, you know, no longer being able to use that. And I remember going back into college, and my, like, it was my second and third semesters, I started withdrawing from, like, every class. I was, like, failing out. I felt stupid. I felt ashamed. I felt like I wasn't disciplined enough, that somehow I couldn't keep up. And it was a year went by before there was a red flag that something was happening. And that was my problem, right? I own my journey in that. And I also wonder if Voc Rehab or the system, if it, things had been full kitted, like the minute I withdrew, there was detection signs. This is my journey. There's no blame here. I just feel the pain of what some of these students are going through and how lost. And to go to a case manager that you don't know, a counselor that you meet once a quarter, and to reveal your deepest, darkest struggles is tough. So when you build full kit, you think of all the things these kids are going to need to be successful. And you don't hope it will happen. You don't rely on individual expertise, but it's built into your system. And the ambitious target that Utah State's going to talk about, over 20, it's a 21% improvement. That's significant. Will they hit it? I don't know. Maybe they'll get 10%, 15%. But with the existing resources, it's outstanding. They've done one of the best full kit implementations I've seen. So I want to turn the rest of the time to them. We want to learn in the journey with all of you guys, and we really appreciate Dan and Dave letting us partner with you. So.
Thank you very much, Executive Director Cox. This has been a great experience for us. My name is Robert Wagner, and I'm Vice President for Academic and Instructional Services at Utah State. In just a minute here, you'll be hearing from my colleague, John Louvier, who works with me. At Utah State, just like your institutions, we have been very concerned and very focused on improving our retention and completion rates. A couple of years ago, under the direction of then Provost Cockett, we were able to initiate a student success task force, which has been very successful for us at our institution, mainly because it took professionals and staff who care about student success from different divisions across the institutional landscape and brought us together in the same room to discuss and talk about what we can do to improve student success, to take those silos down and to really build on common goals. And so the opportunity with this pilot with the Governor's Office of Management and Budget fell very, very nicely into the efforts of that Student Success Task Force. What I wasn't expecting, though, was what the theory of constraints and the ideas associated with full kitting, what that would bring to our discussions. And really what it did was it allowed us to dive down into specific processes and procedures that we have been doing as an institution and really look to see if they're helping or if they're hindering student success. And that has just been a great experience and a humbling one to realize that perhaps some of the institutional processes that we've had for a number of years can actually be identified and defined as constraints and things that aren't helping our students to succeed. Our theory with our Student Success Task Force had been to the theory of a rising tide raises all boats. So what can we do with high impact practices to affect as many students as possible to see that retention and completion rate go up? What this pilot program has done for us, though, is it's helped us to adjust our sights, specifically to drill down into populations of students, some of which are the most most vulnerable students that we have and really look at what are we doing to help them succeed? What are we doing to retain them, to help them complete and meet their higher education goals? And very quickly, as we looked at the data and looked at the constraints that were a part of our processes, we fell upon, if I can get this to go, we fell upon our first gen students. These are our first gen, first time, full time, 4-year degree seeking students on our Logan campus. Now, again, the idea is to get very, very specific. This represents roughly about 400 students. And so although it seems like we are narrowing down, it does have a big impact, especially to our incoming freshman class. If you look at these numbers, the first year, the second year, and the third year, historical retention rates of this population of students has been much lower than their counterparts. 60.1% as opposed to 73% of the rest of their student peers. So our first goal with our pilot project is to look at the constraints, take down those constraints through a full kit strategy that my colleague John will be explaining, with the idea of actually raising the retention rates of these first-gen students to that of their peers. Now, that's just step one, and we aren't going to stop there. Of course, we want that retention rate to go higher, but we feel like with this specific population of students, we can do that. In so doing, we're then measuring our full kit practices that our goal then will be to scale to affect a much wider and a broader population of students, to go back to our original goal, which is rising tide raises all boats, to really help and influence the retention and completion rates of as many students as we can. Once again, in order to do that, we had to break silos. We can get it to go. And this has been a joint effort. Not only our Student Success Task Force, but our pilot team is actually a subset of our Student Success Task Force. And it involves the members of our Division of Student Affairs, as well as our advising team, Academic Instructional Services, and our IR office, getting all of those people in the room to really talk about what full kitting or what our what we're going to do to help this population of students. So I'm going to turn the time to my colleague now.
Okay, so I am going to represent where the rubber meets the road, more or less, in this full kit process. I'm mostly representing the top two groups, the Division of Student Affairs and Advising, because they are the ones tasked with most of the work. Now, our office is Academic and Instructional Services, and we work very closely with our IR office, and we will be doing a lot of the evaluation, the project management, and the reporting to support the Student Affairs and Advising groups. So, let me kind of walk you through really what we're trying to accomplish in our full kit. What we found is that we, as students come into the university, we need to ensure that expectations are met and that they understand what not only what their expectations are as a successful student, but also that they understand what we expect them to do as a successful student. So it's really a communication problem in mostly when they first come into the institution. The next part is that we need to enact on these students before they come to the institution. So this full kit actually begins upon admission to the institution. So that's right around February, March timeframe. And that's when they receive some orientation materials. And these materials are in the form of training modules. And really that's to provide them the information that they need to help them register, which is in April. Now, April is the time frame once that we can then identify this cohort of students that we're working with. So we can identify what we're calling our first scholars. And that's when we can start to enact these targeted the activities that we'll be doing with our full kit. Now, the goal for these students and where the full kit ends, so the scope of this, is that is in the third semester. So the primary suite of activities happens when they are admitted, once they've registered, in that summer before they actually start classes in the fall term. And then in the fall term, they get a very heavy dose of activities and interventions and so forth that we can assist those students. And then into their second term, which would be our spring term, we continue throughout there. And then the goal is to get them to move on to the third term. And in that time frame, we then begin a new cycle of students to go through. So that's really the scope of this initiative and these activities. So with this, to really just sort of summarize what the suite of activities are, is the first thing we need to do is we have to identify this group of students. So we do that through certain characteristics, which Robert talked about, the first-time, first-gen students. They're there on their Logan campus. And then we do measurements throughout the term. And these are behaviors that we can act on. So some of them are understanding whether they've filled out a financial aid form. Have they been meeting with an advisor when they've been given opportunities to do that? Have they attended our connections programs? Have they been going into the orientation modules? Have they done the behaviors that are part of the orientation modules? So we run those a few times during the semester, and if they haven't or they have, it determines on what we do to interact with them in the activities. The other component to this is a really very focused set of personalized advising. Now, there's two parts to that. One is we want to educate them and get them the behaviors that are necessary to be successful. The other component of that is that we're creating relationships with these students, with our staff members, and facilitating relationships with some peer mentors that we have involved in this program, which is very important in terms of success and helping them move on and persist on to graduation. Another component to this is what we're doing is what I call timely program evaluation. So we have a bunch of activities that are part of this full kit. Now, understanding whether these activities are doing what they should be doing is something that we need to do at the end of each term. So we're using a lot of our robust analytics systems to be able to measure the effectiveness of these activities based on student persistence and how well they're performing or not. And then we're reevaluating how well those activities are designed and working with the program directors of those to make sure that it's doing what we had expected. And the last component that we're doing, and this goes throughout, is we're doing somewhat of a degree planning audit with these students. So we're using a program called DegreeWorks, and we're making sure that all these students have a degree plan, that they're committed to a degree plan, and that's really all that we're looking for. And helping them understand that here are the courses that you need to take in this order. And also, we're working with them in suites of what we're calling meta majors, that they can be very efficient. So they may not have to select their final terminal degree that they're going to be due in their first and second semester, but we want to get them headed in the right direction, and then let them know not only that they can readjust, but it's okay to readjust and refine where they're headed and how to do that efficiently. And so this is really, in a nutshell, these are our full kit of activities that we're doing, and we're hoping that we'll improve the retention rates of not only these first scholar students, but then we can scale that up to our larger set of students who we're working with at the university. So with that, thank you very much for your time and this opportunity to present this to you, and I hope you all enjoy your lunch.
You can't afford them. Maybe if it's okay, if I could just ask, because you indicate that you had a student success workforce that was underway. And so now with the introduction of the theory of constraints and flows and those kinds of things. I would like to know, in a little bit more specifics, what were the things that you found, having gone through an effort at the university level to have student success, what were some examples of the constraints you found that you are now pulling out of the system, or that, you know, high-impact practices that you're introducing as a result of this specific pilot?
Yeah, so it's a couple, it's kind of, oops, I went backwards here. So I can go back to this slide right here. It's really in that top bullet there, which is the expectation. So these students were missing their behaviors that they were doing. So they're not understanding that a degree plan is necessary, and they weren't registering for courses.
So that was not part of your original student success task force?
No. No, that's one we identified. So as we started, well, first we started looking at some of the retention from that being a larger goal that we had, of which groups were not performing as we would like, as high as others. And this first scholars group is one that stood out very quickly. And then we started to dig into what are the behaviors of these first scholar students. They're different than our other students.
Yeah.
This full kit is in addition to what all other students receive. So all of our students that come into the institution receive the options to go to these orientation activities, to meet with advisors, to attend the Connections programs, which are all providing scaffolding and training necessary. But this group of students, for some reason, are not getting the information and not behaving the way that we would expect the students that are retained at higher rates. So that's how the process that we went through with the Student Success Task Force to help refine our decision making.
So as part of this process, then, when the pilot's completed, will we have an understanding of what the cost of those additional efforts are that you're providing that are not being provided to other students?
Absolutely, yes. Okay. And then how we can scale that up. So part of this is also a sustainability model in terms of how we can sustain this and then grow it to scale.
I'm to your right, but if there's a button on that micro. Can someone push that?
So obvious when you talk about it, you're like, well, duh. The challenge is we never make our assumptions explicit about what a full kit means for a different population. And when you don't have an explicit assumption, it's very difficult to organize your entire system around an explicit set of assumptions. So you can say, this is what we need to look at for early feedback. This is when we need to intervene. This is how we synchronize services, because we now are explicit that somebody's not hitting this benchmark. And now we can organize and hit that as a high priority. And it's such a simple thing. And we move forward in my office all the time. Let's start a new initiative. It's not full kitted. What are the outcomes? What are the requirements? Who has to be involved? You have to go slow to go fast sometimes. And it's really one of the simplest concepts to understand. It's sometimes difficult to implement. And normally, in the systems I've been in government, we just don't do it because we don't think about it, or we don't assume, or we're not explicit about it. And this team, their full kit was really thinking, what are the five modules, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are the five modules explicitly that these kids should have starting early so that we can synchronize, get the right data, et cetera. So they were so good at it.
Well, I appreciate that. I would assume that this pilot, if you're looking to measure your success at the third semester, it would be helpful, though, in identifying those key factors that are allowing for improvement, that we could communicate that to our other institutions sooner than waiting till the end of the third semester, just so that our presidents and their people can be working, identifying whether those same conditions exist in those other institutions. So thank you very much for being here. I think this is something that we'll hopefully continue to have reports out on as the other institutions move forward as well. And thank you, Chris, for all your support.
Thanks for working, President Cockett, President Whaler, President Heffleton, and Dave Wilson-Hume, all of you guys. We're learning. Some pilots are more mature than others. We appreciate the opportunity. We have a handout that just summarizes on the back what the pilots are, so you know what we're looking at. But at the end of the day, it's just, how do we use existing resources differently? And we don't know how it works in higher ed, so we're learning. So we appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
These guys are awesome.
We will now adjourn for lunch, which is back in the atrium down where.
Today.
Pardon?
Yeah.
They're going to get their steps in today.
Yeah, this, we'll get a full tour of the campus. No, but just right down where we were located before. Remember that we have the opportunity as regents to meet with students, and we'll take an Atlas plan an hour, so we'll be meeting back here at 10 to 1.